Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Gregory Stockel presents this week's Education Report. He tells us what some American states are doing to ease teacher shortages. Later, we hear the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, Jill Robbins joins Dan Novak for this report.
Olga Lopatkina is a Ukrainian mother of 6 children. She had adopted the children, orphans who had lost their parents, legally taking them into her family as her own. A few months ago, the children were in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol and unable to leave. She was worried about them. The children had spent their vacation in the port city. But then the war with Russia began. Her adopted children were suddenly alone and afraid in a city at war. All they had now was her oldest son, Timofey, who was 17 years old. He promised to take care of his younger siblings. There was no clear choice for Olga. Trying to rescue the children herself would be dangerous. Getting others to help the children might put them in danger. That was the beginning of her battle against Russia. Associated Press reporters said that Russia is openly working to take Ukrainian children and bring them up as Russians. They found thousands of children separated from their parents in shelters in Mariupol and other cities and at homes for orphans in the Russian-supported separatist territories of Donbas. They include those whose parents were killed by Russian bombing and others in the care of government organizations.
Russia claims that the children do not have parents or guardians to look after them, or the parents are not available. But the AP reported that officials have sent Ukrainian children to Russia or Russian-held territories without getting their approval. They lied to the children, saying that their parents did not want them. AP said Russia used the children for propaganda and gave them Russian families and citizenship. AP said its investigation is the largest to date on the taking of Ukrainian children. It is the first to follow the process all the way to those already growing up in Russia. The AP spoke to many parents, children and officials in both Ukraine and Russia. It used emails, letters, Russian documents, and Russian state media. Whether or not the children have parents, raising the children of war in another country or culture can be a sign of genocide. That is, it is an attempt to remove the identity of an enemy nation. Lawyers say that Russian President Vladimir Putin is responsible for the policy. He has openly supported adoptions. Stephen Rapp is a former U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues. He is helping Ukraine bring legal charges against Russia over the children. Even when parents are dead, Rapp said, their children must be sheltered, cared for, or adopted in Ukraine rather than sent to Russia. Russian law bars the adoption of foreign children. But in May, Putin signed an order making it easier for Russia to permit adoptions and give citizenship to Ukrainian children without parental care. The law also makes it harder for Ukraine and surviving family members to win them back.
Russia also has prepared a list of Russian families for Ukrainian children and pays them for each child who gets citizenship, up to $1,000 for those with disabilities. Petro Andrushenko is an advisor to the Mariupol mayor. He said, "It is absolutely a terrible story." He claimed hundreds of children were taken from Mariupol. "We don't know if our children have an official parent or step-parents or something else because they are forcibly disappeared by Russian troops." The situation is complex because many children in Ukraine's orphanages are not orphans at all. Ukraine's government said that most children of the state are not orphans, have no serious illness or disease, and are in an institution because their families are in difficult circumstances. It is difficult to find the exact number of Ukrainian children sent to Russia. Ukrainian officials claim it is nearly 8,000. Russia has not given a number, but officials regularly announce the arrival of Ukrainian orphans in Russian military planes. Olga Lopatkina's teenage son, Timofey, had become like a father to all his stepbrothers and stepsisters. Three had long-term illnesses or disabilities, and the youngest was just 7 years old. They suffered through the intense bombing. They tried to leave Mariupol, but pro-Russia forces at a checkpoint would not accept the children's documents. Instead, the officials took the children to a hospital in the Donetsk People's Republic, or DPR, a separatist Russian-controlled area in Ukraine. The Donetsk officials told Lopatkina she could have her children back if she came through Russia to Donetsk to get them in person.
Lopatkina feared a trap. If she went to Russia, she might never be able to leave. She and her husband had moved to France, where she took a job at a factory. The children asked when they could go home to their mother. They were badly fed, hit, and mistreated, Timofey said. After 2 months of negotiation, DPR officials finally agreed to let a volunteer, with permission from Lopatkina, collect the children. They asked Timofey if he and Olga's other children wanted to go back with his foster family or stay in Donetsk. "Now that I have a chance, I will, of course, go home to my parents," he told them. Timofey met his father in Berlin. They drove to France, where Timofey went to meet his mother at the factory as a surprise. When Timofey arrived, she was in shock. For him, the happiness was intense, like nothing he had ever experienced before. Back at the house, the other children were waiting. They ran toward their mother and jumped into her arms. "Let me see you," she screamed. The two dogs joined the party, barking. It took Timofey several days before he could believe he was really back with his parents. He no longer had to act like a father to his siblings. "I kept my promise," he said. "I'm a child now." I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Some schools in the southern United States are dealing with severe teacher shortages. Many of these schools are turning to teaching candidates without teaching certificates or official training. In 2019, Alabama legislatures passed laws easing teacher requirements and permitting emergency certificates. The Associated Press reports that teachers without certificates often work at low-income and majority black school systems. Some schools in Texas eased official certification requirements for about 1 in 5 new teachers last school year. In Oklahoma, an adjunct program permits schools to employ teachers who do not have teacher training if they meet the local school's qualifications. And in Florida, former military members without a 4-year university degree can teach for up to 5 years using temporary certificates. School systems decide if they will accept uncertified candidates, have crowded classes, or employ part-time teachers. Maxie Johnson is a member of the board overseeing the Dallas Independent School District. He said, "I've seen what happens when you don't have teachers in the classroom. I've seen the struggle." He made this statement shortly before the school board approved expanding the use of uncertified teachers. He said that he would rather have someone that a principal approved for a teaching position. The Southern Regional Education Board is a nonprofit education group. It researched information from the years 2019 and 2020 from 11 states. The group found that about 4% of teachers were uncertified or teaching with an emergency certificate. In addition, 10% were teaching out of field. That means they are teaching a different age group or subject than they are certified to teach. The group predicts that as many as 16 million students in the area might be taught by an unprepared or inexperienced teacher by 2030. The group's Megan Boren said, "The shortages are getting worse and morale is continuing to fall for teachers. Many states have eased teaching requirements since the COVID-19 pandemic. Nearly all states have emergency or temporary licenses that permit a person who has not met requirements for certification to teach." Shannon Holston is the policy chief for the nonprofit National Council on Teacher Quality. She said such candidates only temporarily deal with a shortage. Holston said those teachers usually do not stay as long as other teachers. In a 2016 study, the U.S. Department of Education said 1.7% of all teachers do not have full certification. The department noted that number was almost 3% for schools with many minority students or students learning English. The use of teachers without full certification is not evenly spread across fields and subjects. Rural Bullock County, for example, had no certified math teachers last year in its middle school. Nearly 80% of its students are Black, 20% are Hispanic, and 70% of all students are poor. Christopher Blair is the area's former school superintendent. He said he had a difficult time employing teachers. Poor areas cannot pay teachers as much as wealthier neighboring areas. The cities of Birmingham and Montgomery are also in Alabama. Each city had 3 middle schools where more than 20% of teachers had emergency certifications. Birmingham School's spokesperson Cheryl Stewart said officials seek good candidates for emergency certifications and then give them the support they need. She said that pool of candidates in education schools has drastically reduced, but the demand for high-quality educators is still there. I'm Gregory Stockel.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the presidential election of 1804. Thomas Jefferson, the nation's 3rd president, was easily re-elected. Jefferson was head of the Democratic Republican Party, known today as the Democratic Party. Thomas Jefferson had a very good record during his first term as president. He ended many taxes, he paid government debts, and he gained possession of the huge Louisiana Territory from France without going to war. His political opponents were the Federalists. The Federalists were sure Jefferson would win the election of 1804. Still, they were surprised by the strength of his victory. Jefferson won 162 electoral votes. His Federalist opponent won just 14. In the early 1800s, Britain and France were at war with each other. The United States remained neutral. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says President Jefferson did not want to become involved in a war.
He was sufficiently pro-French that he didn't want to ally with the British, but not so pro-French that he wanted a war with the British.
Jefferson also believed getting involved in a European war would destroy all the progress he had made at home. His economic policies had helped to pay much of America's national debt, and he was able to reduce taxes. But staying neutral was not easy. The United States was having trouble with Britain. For many years, Britain had been taking men by force to serve in its navy. Britain claimed the right to seize any British citizen anywhere. The custom was called impressment. Conditions in the Royal Navy were not good at that time, and many sailors deserted. Some went to work on American ships. The American ships were stopped and searched in British waters. Anyone born in Britain was seized. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says sometimes American citizens were also taken.
There was also still something of an imperial attitude in Britain towards America. You know, they were still insisting that some American citizens had been born British. It was often difficult for them to be able to distinguish between their own subjects and Americans.
Several thousand sailors were taken off American ships during the early 1800s. In 1807, an incident made relations between Britain and America even more tense. Britain believed that four of its sailors had deserted and fled to an American ship called the Chesapeake. The United States said the men were American citizens who had been forced to serve in the British Navy. The United States refused to return them. When the Chesapeake sailed out of American waters, the British ship Leopard tried to stop and search it. The American captain would not stop. First, the British ship fired two warning shots. Then, it fired all its guns directly at the Chesapeake. The American ship could do little to defend itself. The captain surrendered. News of the British attack spread quickly. President Jefferson ordered all British Navy ships in American waters to leave at once. He told people not to aid the British. He said any person, American or British, who disobeyed his orders would be arrested. In response, the British government announced a new rule. It said any American ship sailing to Europe must stop first in Britain to get permission. Ships violating the rule would be seized. Relations between the two countries were reaching the breaking point. Impressment was just one of the major problems the United States was having with Britain in the early 1800s. Another problem was trade. Britain wanted to stop the United States from trading with France and its colonies. British warships blocked the port of New York all through 1805. No American ship could leave without being searched. Any ship found to be carrying goods for France was taken north to Halifax, Nova Scotia. There, a British court had the power to seize the goods and force the ship's owners to pay a large fine. In the closing days of 1807, President Thomas Jefferson signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter or leave the United States. Jefferson did not believe that trade embargoes were the best way to settle America's problems with other nations, but at the time, he thought an embargo was the only way to deal with Britain and France short of war, and he did not want war. Jefferson later explained why he thought the embargo was the best choice of action. He said, if American ships had sailed out of American waters, they would have been seized by Britain or France. That would have forced the United States into war. Jefferson said it was far better to stop all contact with these nations until they returned to some sense of justice. Jefferson acted to protect American traders, ship owners, and sailors. Yet those were the people who protested the loudest against the ban. They were willing to take the chance of having Britain or France seize their ships and goods. They could not make any money without trade. The situation quickly turned into a political battle between the Jeffersonian Republicans and the opposition Federalists. Federalist newspapers attacked Jefferson. They called him a tool of France and its leader. They charged that Jefferson supported the trade ban to help Napoleon Bonaparte. One Federalist senator wrote a pamphlet against the embargo. He urged northeastern states to refuse to enforce it. Then he went even further. He met secretly with a British official who was sent to Washington to discuss the situation. He told the British official that Jefferson would be forced out of office because of the embargo. Jefferson simply wished to give the trade embargo a fair chance. He considered the embargo less evil than war. But after a time, he thought, this will not be so. If the war should continue in Europe, and if Britain and France continue to act against us, then it would be for Congress to say if war would not be better than the embargo. Jefferson hoped that the loss of American trade would force Britain and France to change their policies toward the United States. And he hoped the change would come quickly. He knew that the American people would not accept a long ban on trade. A British traveler visiting New York City described what the embargo had done. The port is full of ships, but all of them are closed. Only a few sailors can be seen. Many of the counting houses are closed. The coffee houses are almost empty. The streets near the water are almost deserted. Grass has begun to grow upon the docks. America's northern industrial states felt the loss of trade most deeply. But the agricultural South also was affected. Rich Southern farmers and planters suddenly found themselves poor. Tobacco was one of their major crops, and Britain bought more American tobacco than any other country. Because of the embargo, the price of tobacco fell so low that it had almost no value. The price of wheat fell from $2 a bushel to 7 cents a bushel. Good farmland dropped in value until it was worth almost nothing. Opposition to the embargo was growing. The opposition was strongest in the Northeast. Ship owners and traders believed that the embargo was wrong. They continued to export goods secretly. Some traders began sending goods over land to Canada. From there, the goods were sent on to Britain. Congress passed a law against this kind of trade, but the shipments did not stop. Too many people were willing to violate the law for the large amounts of money they could make by trading secretly with Britain. By August 1808, Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin had lost all hope that the embargo would be successful. Gallatin told President Jefferson that the embargo was defeated by open violations. Another of Jefferson's supporters gave the president some advice. If the embargo could be enforced, and if the people would accept it, then I am sure it would be the wisest course. But if it cannot be enforced completely, and if the people will not accept it, then it will not serve its purpose and should not be continued. Jefferson, however, was not ready to give up his plan. In his last State of the Union message to Congress, he painted a bright picture of the nation. He reported that American industry was making progress. Many goods that had been imported before the embargo were now being made at home. He said almost all of the national debt had been paid, and he said more than 100 gunboats had been built, enough, he declared, to defend the country. Jefferson said nothing about opposition to the embargo, nor did he talk about the serious economic problems caused by it. He said only that Britain and France still refused to honor American neutrality, and so the embargo must continue. The rest of the nation was not so sure. Congress began debating a number of proposals to either lift or amend the embargo. In the first months of 1809, Congress finally approved a bill. The bill lifted the ban on trade with all European countries except Britain and France. Jefferson had hoped to continue the embargo a little longer and with more powers to enforce it. He was not satisfied with the final bill, but he signed it anyway on March 1st. 3 days later, the 15-month-old embargo was dead, and the United States had a new president.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.